Hey, everybody, and thanks again for coming back to Serial Zombie Mom. This is part two of the West Memphis 3 case. Just a recap really quick about the three boys murdered in the Robin Hood Hills area of West Memphis, Arkansas. It was Michael Moore, Christopher Byers, and Stevie Branch. Again, 3 8-year-old little boys that were found underwater in the drainage ditch and pretty much pinned to the creek bed. Now, I'm going to go into just a little bit of detail here that I find a little bit disturbing. And I'm going to go ahead and just kind of go into like where the cops kind of went wrong. Now, I will go into a little bit more later, but there were some problems for me as I watch things and as I see kind of what's going on. You know, they tape off the area, they pull these bodies out of the water initially, you know, and they just go lay them on the bank. You know, they don't drain the water ahead of time. They're also, you know, once they start draining this water, they're trampling through all this fucking mud, like, and disturbing evidence. You know, so there's definitely some issues there. Now, again, it was early 93. There were still some, you know, questions as to how to handle crime scenes. And then there was some question on how much they knew. They didn't know shit and know how to handle these things. I mentioned at one point, you know, this is not something that happened there. This is not something that they were used to. So I want you guys to keep some of that in mind, that this was not normal for them. Okay. So, I just spoke to you guys about, what happened to the boys, how they were found, a little bit about their autopsy result. And, you know, if you listen to that, like I gave you the trigger warning for a reason, it was rough. Okay. These poor boys went through something crazy. I will mention a little bit more of all that again later, but I will give that trigger warning, or I will try to give that trigger warning before I get started. So, but, you know, I think due to the time period, and everything that was going on around this area and being the Bible Belt and after the satanic panic set in, you know, I think these three boys didn't really have a chance in hell. The three teens didn't really have a chance in hell, you know, excuse the phrase and the, you know, the hell connection here, but, you know, I think it was just one of those things. They had to blame somebody and they had to do it quick. So I'm going to get into just a little bit more information. We did speak about the interrogation of Jesse Miss Kelly as well, 17-year-old who had diminished mental capacity and didn't really understand what was being asked of him. So, you know, now I'm going to kind of jump into a little bit more of the information, kind of what happened from this point on, okay? So, anyway, after they get this supposed confession from Jesse, they arrest Damien and Jason. He thinks he's going to go free, okay? Jesse thinks he's going to go free. And then they say, nope, you're here too because you've incriminated yourself. Now, 8 months later, on February 17th of 1994, he makes another statement to the police with his lawyer in the room. Now, his lawyer kept telling him not to say anything, but he ignored the lawyer and went into detail about the murder and abuse of the boys. Now, somehow, more details were leaked, and there were obviously many police errors and misconceptions during this investigation. These officers, as I started to mention, were not prepared to deal with a case like this. None of the officers involved were officially trained to handle homicides, let alone a crime scene for a homicide. So with this being said, they didn't know what the fuck they were doing. You know, usually you'll get a card from somebody, hey, I'm from homicide, blah, blah, blah. When they came to talk to Damien, when they came to talk to Jason, and they hand over a card, you got one that's in, like, auto theft, and one that's from something else. None of them said homicide. None of them were homicide detectives. Like, one was, I think, drugs, and the other one was the auto theft or some shit. They were not prepared or educated enough to deal with a homicide. There was, I believe, at some point where a jurisdiction nearby had said, hey, if you need help with the case, you know, we've got our homicide detectives that can come in and help you. And they said, no, we got this. We'll handle it. I have a problem there. If you don't know what the fuck you're doing, don't be afraid to ask for help. There's nothing wrong with asking for a little bit of help. I would much rather have pulled in people from two or three other surrounding communities that knew what they were doing and get the help than fuck it all up. Now, they convinced the families that these three teen boys killed these 8-year-old boys. In reality, however, there were witnesses showing Jesse Miss Kelly was at home or close to home at the time of the murders. Jason Baldwin had just been at his grandmother's or aunt's or somebody's and had just cut the grass for them. Damien was home with his girlfriend. His pregnant girlfriend. And his family. Like, they knew there was no way that these boys had done this. But nobody wanted to listen. And anytime somebody came forward to say, or tried to come forward to say, they wouldn't listen. Now, there was a woman that I mentioned earlier. Her name is Miss Vicky Hutchison. And she had been a new resident of West Memphis. And she later claims that she had coercion from the police as well. Now, on May 6th, so the day that the boys are found, she takes a polygraph. This is the day they were found, and this polygraph happens before the boys' bodies are found. All right? Keep some of this information in mind. This polygraph is regarding her taking money from her employer. Her son, also 8 years old, was also present and supposedly was a distraction for her for a proper polygraph. Now, this little boy, also 8 years old, was also a playmate of the three slain boys. He mentions that the boys were killed at the playhouse, a place called the Playhouse. Now, when the boys were found, it was determined that it was quite near where this little boy indicated, and he claims that he witnessed the murders committed by Satanists who spoke Spanish, but that other statements were very inconsistent and obviously made up. The boy was unable to identify Baldwin, Eccles, or Miss Kelly in lineups. Now, there was also no actual playhouse near the indicated area. However, we don't know what they called the area. Now, instead of saying, hey, let's go meet by the drainage pipe, it could have just been, that might be our playhouse area. So that's always a possibility that they might have called it that, but we don't know. Now, this is where the satanic idea comes about in the media, and they run with this idea with the satanic panic. It had been recent with the Geraldo Rivera shit, and it's just a bullshit document itself that, you know, yeah, you might have in the whole U.S., you're going to have people that are going to make, you know, paganism, Wiccan, you know, even Satanism look bad. Because if you do the research on even that, like, just in some documentaries that I've watched just for shits and giggles, you know, you see things about Satanism and the people who really follow and consider themselves Satanists follow the fact that he was just an angel that was cast out of heaven. That's what they follow. That's what those people follow. They don't follow the idea that he makes everybody do bad. Like, they don't follow everything of that. So people, the only thing I say is do your fucking research, people. Before you want to sit there and criticize somebody for what they believe in, do your research. You know, whatever, you know, agnostic, Satanist, you know, Catholic, Protestant, I don't give a fuck what you are. You treat me all right, I got you. Like, we're good. You know, don't fuck with me, I won't fuck with you. It's that simple. You know, no one should be criticized for what they believe in. All right? As long as they're not doing horrible things. Now, granted, you're going to have those couple people who follow the wrong part of it, and they're going to do weird shit, and you're going to have, you know, there are places, there's a place in, up near, the Bridgewater Triangle, and I'm going to talk about that at one point, where it's going to talk about, some Satan rituals, and where there were, like, human sacrifices, and things like that. But, again, we see that in all sorts of different cultures. You know, as I mentioned with the cannibalism stuff on Isesagawa, you know, we find out that there was all these different things done in all these different tribes and cultures. You know, it is what it is. So, you know, again, just do your research. That's all I ask everybody. These officers obviously didn't do their fucking research. You know, and Damien was well-versed in it. He looked at all this stuff as just really interesting information, and that's where he went with it. Now, on June 1st of 1993, this Vicky Hutchison agrees to police suggestion to bug her home and have an encounter with Damien Eccles. Jesse introduces her to Damien, and there's no incriminating statements ever made during this visit. However, the police try to state that the recording is inaudible, regardless of the claim that she says, no, I listened to it. Everything was fine. There wasn't anything said that was incriminating. Like, there was nothing. The following day, she tells police that 2 weeks after the murder, that she, Damien Eccles, and Jesse Miss Kelly had attended a Wiccan coven meeting, and that a drunken Damien Eccles bragged about the murders. The following day was the first day that they questioned Jesse Miss Kelly. So they hear this shit from this woman, and they were looking for someone to blame. That's it. When Vicky was unable to recall the location of the meeting and or even the people that were there, that showed them, look, you can't identify one fucking person. You can't show me or take me to this place where you guys say that there you guys had this meeting. Bullshit. She obviously was lying. Now, coincidentally, she was not charged with stealing money from her employer, which was what she was there to do a polygraph about to begin with. She avoided any issues, any arrest, any of that stuff for this charge. She later claims that that was the only reason she ever implicated the three boys was to avoid these charges and also to get a reward in the discovery of the boys. So she got a monetary reward about these boys' little bodies. She got a reward when she didn't know shit. And all she did was fucking lie. Now, I want to talk about Paul Gitchell for just a second as well. Paul Gitchell is like the lead on the case, okay? He was the one that did all the press conferences and all this shit. He was gunning for these boys the second that their names entered his ears, okay? He was gunning. He was absolutely determined to lock these boys up. Now, in a press conference where they ask him on a scale of 1 to 10 how confident he was that these boys did this, This cocky son of a bitch states,
it's an 11.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you that these boys did this? And this is solving the case.
11.
I feel at this point, he fucked himself in the teens, and he knew it. He knew he had to make all this stick, regardless of everything, because he didn't want to damage his reputation. There's later interviews with him where he still sticks with the fact that he thinks these boys did it, and he will keep sticking with it and keep sticking with it. Well, even when he is presented with other things, he refuses to listen. He is a cocky son of a bitch, and he is that way through the entire trial. He is that way through the entire investigation. And then you find out that he's about to retire. And he states something about, I hope this is my last case and like this and, you know, maybe my last case ever and blah, blah, blah. And I plan on retiring or whatever. And they all are speculating, you know what? I bet you he's going to run for office or he's going to do something along those lines. Now, whether he did or not, I didn't really look into because I don't give a shit about this piece of shit. Like, I don't know. He's just such a cocky asshole. Like, if he realized later, I would have so much more respect for him if he would have come out later and been like, yeah, you know what? You know, I don't know that these boys did it. You know, I got ahead of myself. I thought that they did. And now that there's things that are making me question it. If he would have at least said, I really don't know, I'd probably have a little more respect for him. But the fact that he went so fucking cocky as to say, you know, 11 out of 10 that these boys did it, you know, and sticks with this bullshit all the way through. It's ridiculous. So I'm going to go ahead and start on the trials. I'm going to go ahead and talk a little bit about these trials. Now, Jesse Miskelly was tried separately from Damien and Jason. Okay. And under the Bruton rule, his confession could not be admitted against his co-defendants. So this is why he was tried separately. All three defendants pleaded not guilty. They all said they didn't do it. Now, I do want to say, as you watch things, and when you watch that first part of Paradise Lost, you're going to question Damien. You really are. Like, I had seen other documentaries before and read things before I sat down and actually watched The Paradise Lost, okay? But at the end of it, you're questioning, and you're like, I don't know. Like, he says things, you know, the way he acts about things, you know. But I think at that point, it was a shock value for Damien. That it was a, you know what? You think I'm so fucking bad? Let me show you bad. You know, I don't give a fucking shit. Like, he had this I don't give a shit attitude, you know, and he would say some things sometimes, but I think it was just more of the shock value. Okay? And you'll kind of see that. But as time goes on, you realize that that's really all he was doing at that time. Now, during Jesse Miskelly's trial, Richard Ofshe, who is an expert on false confessions and police coercion, testified that the interrogation of Jesse Miskelly was a quote-unquote classic example of police coercion. They also discussed that there were a lot of inconsistencies in the confession, as well as from the particulars at the scene, proving that his confession was false. He claims that the boys were raped in the confession. He'll say stuff like, yeah, they started screwing them and stuff. They started screwing them. That's when they started screwing them boys. You know, and there's no evidence really to show that these boys were raped. Their anuses were dilated, okay? So trigger warning there. Maybe you should have said it a little sooner. Yes, the boys' anuses were dilated. However, there is no forensic evidence stating that they had been raped. Dilation of the anus is a normal post-mortem response as the sphincter around the anus relaxes due to decomposition. Okay? It is normal. We see this in other cases. There was questions about Marilyn Monroe and what happened with her, you know, was did she get an enema that killed her? Her anus was dilated. There was irritation, however, with her on the inside of her rectum. So now for her, it's something that possibly could have happened. But you see this on some people and they see that and they initially go, oh, they were raped. But was there trauma to the sphincter? Was there trauma to the entrance, to the edges? Like, there was no trauma. There was no forensic evidence showing that these boys were raped. Now, unfortunately, Jesse Miss Kelly is convicted of first-degree murder and two counts of second-degree murder. And they sentence him to 40 years in prison. What it comes down to is that his coerced confession states that they went to Robin Hood Hills, that the three guys went to Robin Hood Hills, and that one of the boys was trying to get away, that Jesse Miss Kelly, and I think it might have been Chris Byers, I really don't remember which one he supposedly ran down. But that one little boy was trying to get away and he had to run him down and he brought him back to the other guys. But every time that he says something like, yeah, I was there, you know, I saw them, but then I left. Okay, well, then you came back, right? Because then you saw this. Oh, yeah, and then I left. And then you came back again, right? And did this. Yeah, and then I left. So that's what I was talking about with the, and I left. He was trying to constantly remove himself from this issue. He is sentenced to life plus 40 years in prison. Now, Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin's trial started about 3 weeks after Jesse Miss Kelly's. And the prosecution accused them of this satanic murder, calling Dale W. Griffiths to the stand. This man was supposedly a expert on the occult who testified that the murders were satanic. Here's the problem. He got his supposed PhD from an unaccredited online school. And he's questioned, and they're like, you know, okay, well, from, you know, 82 to 86, when you supposedly got your PhD, what classes did you take to qualify you for this PhD? Not one. No credit hours, not one motherfucking class that this fucker took to qualify as a PhD. He just paid the money and they gave him a fucking diploma and the place was unaccredited. He could have tried to say he was an expert on black holes. You know, and I mean, it's bullshit. It's bullshit. So they bring in somebody that doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. And he just, you know, assumes. So this is another thing that irritated the fuck out of me through all of this. The defense did not, or did try to prove that Damien's knowledge of the genital mutilation was due to information released by the media. But the prosecution stated that the knowledge, regardless, was too close to the facts, since no public reporting of drowning or that one child was mutilated more than the others. However, things like that, we do find out now, were released to the media. And if they were found in the drainage canal, wouldn't you assume that they, one of them at least, drowned in the canal, in the water? So yeah, if they're found in there, yes, you're going to assume that there was drowning involved. So, on March 19th of 1994, Jason Baldwin and Damian Eccles were found guilty on 3 counts of murder. Damian Eccles was sentenced to the death penalty, and Jason Baldwin to life in prison, with no possibility of parole. There are so many things wrong with this case. You see interviews with Jason's mother, who, and I'm going to say this, yes, she has problems with some mental issues herself, mental illness, but they don't say exactly what her mental illness is. You know, it could be major depression, clinical depression. It could be, you know, but they just say she's got mental issues. So it makes it look like she's fucking batshit crazy. You know, yes, they all lived in dysfunctional families. All three of these teens grew up in dysfunctional families. That doesn't always mean anything. I mean, yes, we see stuff with like serial killers and things like that. We see dysfunction in their family life. But there's nothing that has been reported to state that they have been at that level, if that makes sense. So there's just a lot of inconsistencies. You see also just how much Jesse Miss Kelly's daddy loved that boy and how much he would do. Now, I mean, you can see he kind of encouraged some of the violence a bit. However, he wouldn't have encouraged something like that. You know, you see interviews with Damien's sister and her and his mother and his girlfriend. You know, you see how much he was loved and how good he was. Seeing that he would, you know, they talk about a fact that he, you know, took a kitten and raised it like and cuddled it like a baby. And how in the hell, all three of these boys are like, you know, regardless of some of the other shit we got into, does not mean we wouldn't do this shit to a kid. Like, I couldn't hurt an animal. I couldn't do, you know, let alone an 8-year-old boy who can talk to me and tell me it hurts. Are you nuts? So there's questions, obviously. A lot of questions. So I'm going to go into the aftermath of all this a little bit. Give you a little bit of more information on some of this stuff. And obviously some things that I have some issues with. So, one issue in this case that I have an absolute problem with, and I kind of have touched on a little bit already, is how the police handled the case and the crime scene. The police trample that creek bed. There's no telling how much evidence may have been lost due to this. This obviously caused issues with any prints that may have been found at the time. You know, like footprints, handprints, you know, whatever. They removed the bodies from the water before the coroner even had arrived or been notified about the bodies at the location. Now, I understand because of where this was that it was pretty impossible to get his vehicle down to the location of the crime. But the coroner should have been, he should have walked his ass down there and put his hands on those bodies and done what he needed to do. But his first time seeing the bodies, they had already been pulled from the water. They had been handled. They had been laid on the bank to decay even more and exposed to more light and insects, Rigor advanced even more. Body temps changed more. Let me explain something here with body temp, okay? When someone dies, we have to look at body temp. Now, it doesn't give you everything. Now, you've got to look at rigor. You've got to look at lividity. You've got to look at all these different things as well as, you know, as well as body temp. You know, you got to put all these things together to get a proper time of death, okay? Time of death is really, really important, especially in these types of cases, okay? This is something that is really interesting to me and something that I find very, very important, okay? So the water temperature should have been taken, as well as the body temperature. And this should all have been done as soon as the bodies were removed. Them being laid on the bank caused the body temperatures probably to rise, and this would mess with the time of death. If it was 60 degrees in the water and 80 degrees in the air, and let's say the bodies had reached the 63 degrees of the water, when they put those bodies on the bank, those bodies are slowly rising temperature because they're going to meet whatever the environment is. For every hour of death, you know, the body temperature is going to change by so many degrees. It's going to, you know, it has to acclimate to the temperature surrounding it. So when you're not looking at that, you're not looking at the coroner was not able to see the status or the amount of rigor at that moment that the bodies were found, at the moment that they were pulled from the water. Not able to look at the temperature of the day at that moment, the temperature of the water at that moment, that's going to give you some questions too. All right. So the water should have been checked. The body temps should have been done. All of that. Now the bodies had been brought all the way up across the drainage pipe and up to the Blue Beacon truck stop, because that's where the coroner's vehicle could get. So they traveled with the bodies. You know, it may not have been, you know, but before the coroner could even look at the fucking bodies, they have been handled. That's going to change lividity. That's going to change so many things bothering these bodies. You're supposed to move them as little as possible until you get them into those body bags and get them on that stretcher. And even then, once you do that, like, things have to be done. That coroner's got to look at these bodies and figure things out. So, he didn't even get telephoned. He didn't get called until 2 hours after the discovery of the floating shoe. I'm sorry, you find that shoe, and then you call and have that damn coroner on standby. You know, hey, we found a shoe, I thought you ought to know, just in case we find something else. You know, and then a few minutes later, hey, we found a body, you need to get down here. You don't wait 2 fucking hours. He was there within about 30 minutes once he was called. But again, that was 2 hours after finding the shoe. Now, the sandbagging and draining of the creek after the bodies were almost already removed also caused issues. All right? Because you're draining all that. Well, what if there was something else floating in the water? What if there was something in the water? Did they test that water? Did they check it for anything? You know, they trampled the ground of that creek bed. It was nothing but mud, so they were in and out of it and climbing all over the place, and it was destroying that creek bed. What if the perpetrator lost something in the water or in the creek bed? It could have been an ID or something to ID this person or people. They did find what was one shoe print, but again, it was never compared to anything, and it was kind of in a kind of muddy area. So whether or not that was something that was found before or after, we don't really know. But I've seen one picture of one shoe print that you can't really get a lot of definition from. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the first episode, they did find small amounts of blood at the scene, but it did not get tested or examined any further. But I'm going to say this, as there's been questions of animal predation. Animals will lap up blood, okay? Whether it be for the minerals in the blood, whether it be for the moisture, whatever, animals, deer, possums, raccoons, whatever, if there's blood, domestic cats will lick up blood. I've seen that firsthand. My stepson has a bloody nose, and if he, you know, leaves a couple drops in the floor, don't be surprised if the cat goes over there and fucking, you know, laps it up a little bit. So there always is the possibility. Now, as much blood as would have been lost with the three boys, you know, I mean, granted, really Christopher Byers would have been the main one because he had the most issues and the most, you know, damage done. But even then, you know, these little boys were put in water. And it was flowing water. So where did that water go? There's a very, very good possibility that's what could have happened. And the mud around there, and the mud would have filtered that blood. It would have soaked up that blood. They did not test the ground. They did not test this mud and dirt and find out if there was human blood saturated into the banks around that. They didn't do that. They didn't know to do that kind of shit back then. And that precinct certainly didn't know to do it because they were not trained in homicide. Now, according to part two of Paradise Lost, there was no blood found at the scene at all, showing that the bodies could have possibly been brought there and dumped and not necessarily murdered them there. I don't know how much of that I believe. I've seen other documentaries and read books and different things. I don't know. I think they possibly were murdered there. So, you know, whether it be right there and whether it be in the water or whether it be in that surrounding area, I don't know. But I truly believe that everything was in that area. That was somewhere they were used to, you know, being and playing. And I don't think that they were murdered somewhere else, personally. The police records were essentially a clusterfuck as well. An absolute mess. Nothing was in order. It was just a bunch of random information that had later to be pieced together by attorneys in order to charge. And in order to understand. Now, in part two of the documentary, it is spoken of that there was a possibility that there were potential human bite marks left on at least one of the victims. However, this determination of the source came about years after the fact. And it was also, however, stated that if they were bite marks, they certainly didn't match Jesse Miss Kelly, Damian Eccles, or Jason Baldwin. They gave their teeth impressions. They gave molds of their teeth to prove their innocence. They did not match. Now, there is speculation that these bite marks could have come from other things. There is the possibility of the snapping turtles. If you've seen a snapping turtle take a bite out of something, their beaks are vicious. And there have been tests done to show that there are similarities to those bites. Okay? Doesn't mean that that's specifically it. They are saying that some of those bites look very human. But, gotta say, you know, snapping turtles were in that area. And when you saw that water in that canal, it was enough where a couple of snapping turtles could be in there. You know, we don't know for sure, but it's some really great information. And at least something to look at. You know, maybe they weren't hurt as bad as we thought they were. And maybe the snapping turtles got a hold of them. It's a very good possibility that the snapping turtle is what actually removed Christopher Byers' genitals. They did not give us an indication in any of these documentaries whether that was done at the time of death. Was he already dead when that was taken off? Was that something while he was moving, while he was alive? Or, you know, they say a lot of the injuries, you know, were possibly post-mortem, but they can't tell for sure. So if it was post-mortem, why is it not a good possibility that it was a snapping turtle that took it off? Animals go for softer flesh. It's what they do. Well, soft flesh on a young boy is gonna be a genital area as well as a mouth or an ear or a nose or soft flesh, kid. Like, it's soft flesh. That's what they're gonna go to. When you see bodies found in water, those kinds of things are gone. They go through the belly because they can't get through other areas. So there's things that you have to look at. I guess maybe I'm a little too morbid. Maybe it's because I watch too much of these, like, medical examiner shows and body farm stuff. And I've, you know, done a bunch of research on stuff. Maybe it puts me as being fucking weird. But I've done enough. I've watched enough of this shit to know that there are multiple possibilities here. Especially from 93, that's a long time ago. Like, we can't go back and look at their body now. Like, all we have to go on is pictures. Now, just a side note, Melissa Byers, Christopher Byers' mother, died in 1996. So 3 years after the fact. Her death was ruled undetermined. There were drugs found in her system, and more than she was just prescribed. And there were sources that state she may have been suffocated. Now, John Mark Byers says that he woke up with her dead next to him. But I'm going to say, this is very suspicious. Just saying. 2 years after her death in 1998, there were still no fucking answers and they wouldn't release stuff to John Mark Byers. Now, in 2007, Damian Eccles petitioned for a retrial based on a statute permitting post-conviction testing of DNA evidence due to technological advances since 1994 that might provide exoneration for the wrongfully convicted. This ruling was thrown out in 2010. Now, there was a question of a knife that was given to the makers of Paradise Lost by John Mark Byers, the adoptive father of Christopher Byers, which has been looked at quite a bit since the documentary. He has been looked at quite a bit since the documentary. When you watch and you watch John Mark Byers, he's a character. And he looks like he's playing a fucking role. His actions are wild and erratic. He's a very odd man. He's preaching and spouting scripture. And he loves the media attention, okay? He is in it. He is in their faces. He is right there. Now, that can be taken one of two ways. It could be, you're gonna hear me because this was my son and this was, you know, and I want to know what happened. Or it could be taken as, look at me, look at me, look at me. Look at me. Woohoo, now I'm in the limelight. All right. When you watch him and everything is put on as a fucking show, he's seen in almost every single documentary, and he eats up the attention, even putting on shows. He glorifies his brain tumor that he had and the medication and needing, like, he makes sure people know. He has himself being filmed while singing in a church, which I'm going to say, I was kind of impressed. He's got a nice voice. When you look at the man, he's got a bit of a droopy eye. He's kind of odd shaped. He's like a big oaf of a man. You know, there's something off about him. Now, when you see his wife, Melissa, Christopher's mother, she tells him on multiple occasions, enough is enough, just let's get the fuck out of here. You know, let's go. I'm done. Like, I don't want to be here anymore. I just want to go home. I want to, you know. She wants to go home. She wants to grieve. She's lost her child. But instead, he keeps talking. He stands there. She winds up outside, you know, whatever. And he's the one talking to the media, not her. She says what she has to say, and she's, all right, let's go. I'm done. Now, she says a bit, and she is so convinced that these boys have, or these teens have murdered her child, that she says some pretty fucking nasty things. And she's a bit of a character herself, but you can see it in her that she is a grieving mother. She is hurting. She's in pain. And I don't fucking blame her for winding up having a drug problem after this. I don't blame her. You know, I'd probably do whatever I could to numb myself if one of my babies left me. You know, I feel for anybody who's lost a child. I feel for them. I've watched my mother after losing my brother. I've watched, you know, I know how I felt, you know, losing pregnancies. I've watched friends of mine and acquaintances of mine who have lost children. I don't know how they can do it. Like, I don't know how they function each day. And, you know, God, please don't make me go through it. But, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We're never given tomorrow. You know, we're never guaranteed tomorrow. So that woman hurt. She was in a lot of pain. All right. But John Mark Byers, you know, and when the cameras are turned off, you hear that he's all, you know, all friendly, but the cameras turn on and he's a dick to everybody involved. And at one point, he gives a knife. This is what started the conversation on John Mark Byers. At one point, he gives a knife to the cameraman for Paradise Lost, Doug Cooper. And he didn't think of it. He's like, all right, well, that's kind of strange that this podunk guy gave me a knife, but whatever. You know, I mean, he's obviously someone who's well-versed with knives and guns and all these things. And they go back to New York City, and they see what appears to be blood on the knife. Like, he never really looked at it before, and he was like, yeah, look at this fucking thing that... And he sees what looks like knife, like blood on the knife. Now, HBO executives say, no, you take that fucking knife back to West Memphis, give it to the police department, and let them look at this shit. Now, John Mark Byers claims that the knife had never been used, or at least, you know, not on a human, after blood was found. And they question him in court. And he mentions, well, you know, I cut some venison with it. Well, do you know any way that there could be human blood on it? Well, yeah, I may have nicked my thumb with it. You know, but then they question that he, you know, Gary Gitchell asks him, you know, where did this come from? Where would blood have come from? And they go through, you know, records of their conversation. Now, he tells Gitchell there's no way that there would be any human blood on it. However, they find blood that could have matched Christopher's blood type. And he tries to suggest that he may have left the knife where the child could have gotten to it, and he could have cut himself, but both John Mark and Chris had the same HLA-DQA genotype, where he did, however, agree to and pass a polygraph about the murders during part two of the documentary. But he was also under the influence of several psychoactive prescription medications that could have affected the test results. So that doesn't give us any promise either. You know, it doesn't mean he had anything to do with it. He's questionable, but we really don't know. So, looks like there's going to have to be a part three to this. I really don't want to do part four. I really don't want to get into four parts with this. I think with the West Memphis 3, I think we should stop at three parts. But there's a lot of stuff going on here. I've only got a couple more little comments to make on this case before we really get before I end the episode. So I just do want to mention just a little bit more. But they did find the possible teeth prints that we mentioned earlier. The three teens gave the teeth impressions. And then they questioned Byers. However, after 1997, he had his teeth removed. You can see in the first document that his teeth fucking suck. Like, they're not great. But supposedly from these psychoactive drugs and everything, which is possible, his teeth, periodontal disease, you know, whatever, they rotted out of his head, so he had the rest of them just pulled. So, no imprints could be made on his original teeth. And when questioned, he pulls his teeth out and he's like, here, you want to test these? Well, they wouldn't have the same imprint as what they would have had before. Now, his reasons for the removal, obviously contradictory. There's a couple of different stories. Somebody said, you know, he said that he lost him in a bar fight. Others say the seizure meds caused the periodontal disease. And others say that, you know, no, he just had him removed because he was having other dental issues that had bothered him for years. Now, we also know that the Byers boy had an imprint of what looked like a belt buckle along his buttocks, and that Byers had actually admitted to spanking him a few times with the belt just before the boys went missing. Now, we do see on one of the boys' faces, there's another imprint above the eye that looks very similar. It was one of these supposed bite marks that looks very similar to a belt buckle. So we're not 100% sure as to what happened here. Again, this is a doozy of a episode of a case. This is a doozy. Like, trying to figure out what happened to these boys. I don't think we'll ever know exactly what happened to these boys. Will we know who did it? Not unless it's a deathbed confession. I don't think we're going to ever find out. But I don't know. There's still other people to look at that I'm going to mention, and I'll do that on the next episode. So, you know, keep up on it. You know, watch the documentaries. Tell me what you think for yourself. But I'm going to end this for now. In the next episode to go with this, we're going to talk about some of the DNA testing, other people involved, like some other things like that you can look at, talk about what happened to these guys, you know, whatever. So we'll talk about that on the next episode. So I will see you on the next one.